on for almost 3 years now.
Versions we saw in Senate. in spite of that, as you indicated, there is always room for improvement. I'd like to identify a few specific issues that might be particularly sensitive, as early as the definitions. If we look at item 1.3, we have a new definition of what data are. That definition is rather extensive, far, far more extensive than any previous definition we've had at McGill. And it includes every idea and every concept we have while we're here. The problem really is later on when we are going to have to document those ideas for 7 years. I think most of us would be very challenged to be able to do that. I think the definition is much too broad and has to be reviewed. Let me give you a couple of other examples. Instead of referring to specific policies throughout the text, you refer to regulatory framework. Regulatory framework is defined in 1.9. 1.9 covers basically every policy that could touch on research coming from provincial or federal agencies and university. And then we are going to have to incorporate those, and every one of us would have to know about them and distribute that information to anybody we work with. I think that's an unrealistic expectation that we would be spending our time monitoring those policies. Certainly it's reasonable for us to apply the university policies. I think that the university would have the responsibility of making sure that our policies are compliant with federal and provincial, which they are. And then we would be responsible for administering those. Two more very quick points. 1.15 says that your university includes all affiliated institutions. Unless we get buy-in from all of the institutions, and I talked to several people in many institutions affiliated to the campus who have never seen this document. It's fairly senior people, and so I would really urge you that to either remove this or to make sure you get buy-in from the affiliated institutions. And my last point at this time is that there is a whole section on hazardous research. And yet you find a lot of terms, but the word hazardous research is not defined. And that's obviously a very broad term that could cover an awful lot of different issues. So if you want to keep the hazardous research concept in the policies, I think it's absolutely essential to define it.
Thank you very much, Senator Levere. We've got a very long speaker's list. I'm going to ask that people make their interventions relatively short. Did you want to respond on this particular? And then I might suggest we take a few interventions and then come back.
Very briefly, the point on data I take, and it's been actually raised by a few people who have been involved in the discussion. And well, all your other points also are.
Thank you, Senator White. I have a couple of points. One is to do with how plagiarism is defined in Section 1.8. So the definition for students is different from the definition for the rest of us. And this is because the student definition is in the Code of Student Conduct. That is to say, for them it's with intent to deceive, but for us it isn't. And this relates to Section 5.1.1, where it is presumed that the researcher plagiarizes knowingly. So I'm just suggesting that you perhaps look into somehow reconciling the slight anomaly there with respect to how we are to treat plagiarism. Then I have a question about Section 4.8, ownership of research data, where there are several sections and paragraphs suggesting how people resolve issues to do with ownership. It was my understanding that the university owns our data. Certainly, Shirk says that the university owns data that is funded by Shirk grants. So I wonder if that issue could be clarified, as to what extent the university owns data, to what extent researchers can argue about who owns data, as in the paragraphs that you have quoted. And my third point is extremely minor, but it's in paragraph 3.3. Is there something missing, or is it a typo? In the case of research conducted by a student for academic credit or a Is there something missing there?
No.
Professor Foster, did you want to speak to that?
The or A should be struck.
Good answer, thank you. I'm assuming, Vice Principal, you're taking this under advisement, and we'll Senator Dooley.
As you mentioned briefly in your motivation, the old regulations on research policy contain two clauses, clauses 10 and 11, which make specific reference to a reporting process, literally a box check for a researcher when they're receiving funding from a government military organization. Why were these clauses not included in the new policy? As these were not anything new, they were a reporting process in the old policy. And is this not maybe a regressive step? I'm just wondering why they weren't included.
Well, we're aligning ourselves with the other universities are doing in Canada. Question on the RDO checklist that you're referring to were actually a little bit confusing because they were not asking you if the research was publicly was funded by military source, at least not previously. It was asking if it had military applications, and that became a matter of opinion almost. And some people were checking yes, some people were checking no. The similar, very, very similar type of research. It is very difficult to really monitor those kinds of changes.
Thank you. Senator
Simeon.
Hello, yes. Two issues. One, I want to have to please take a look at section 7.4.1 on research funds. This section discusses the possibility of having anonymous directed research funding for a particular project. This is particularly problematic in the context of pharmaceutical research or research directed by money coming from corporations towards a particular purpose. I understand, yes, that this research will not be secret, but it's a fundamental part of the accountability of the researcher to the community of peers to report on the sources of funding for a particular project. If a donor wishes to make an anonymous donation to fund research, that donation could go to McGill Foundation, and it could be distributed through the various granting channels that McGill has, and then McGill would be the particular line item there on in the article. The concern here is particular directed anonymous donations for a particular project, and that's their accountability issues of peer review that come up with anonymous funding.
Well, in the case that you described, I wouldn't characterize this as legitimate and good faith. This article would not apply. If the sponsor is trying to hide something, it's not a legitimate reason to not become known.
If I may, I can't think of any possible legitimate reasons to wish to have anonymous funding, firstly. And secondly, who will be responsible for overseeing these requests and overseeing the idea of anonymity here?
Well, the grant office under the leadership of the Vice Principal.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to concur with Senator Smith. There is a problem with Section 7.41. He has a great point that it's difficult to make a decision on what exactly is legitimate and good faith. So this is certainly a problem that is visible to mostly the guild community. And second of all, it looks like Section 7.41 is a loophole in this, so we're trying to make show that we are transparent and we are accountable, builders are accountable, but this would easily let research that seems legitimate. Of course, the research itself is not necessarily secret. It's forbidden. But for example, say someone is doing research on a new metal alloy. Well, it could be a medical institution that is researching this alloy for implants, but it could also be military or whatever. So clearly, this is a loophole that we, unless there are very, very concrete examples, and I honestly could not think of any, there is really no need for this.
Thank you. I really appreciate the efforts that have been made to improve this, and I agree with this. 16.1, in terms of the review, I think 5 years was too long. Since we turned over the DPs, we turned over institutional members.
I think it's useful to have this document, as I think it's much better than the first version. I still have somewhat of a problem with it that it's long and bureaucratic, and it looks as if it's a document written so that if something bad happens, we can point to paragraph 7.5.1.2, you did not do this. Because the number of knots in it is really amazing. I'd much rather have it pass the document that is actually written in a positive way. This is how you're supposed to behave, and not this is wrong. Because we will probably not be able to come up with all possible cases that we do not want to have. So I'm like having a short version would actually be kind of useful, because I don't think you can actually read it before it's really bad, before it's really a problem. I have two concrete questions or suggestions. There's a long list of definitions. One that I missed is actually, what is a publication? Because, for example, in my field of physics, it's actually common to put a lot of publications, articles that one's written up, onto software service X archives first, which constitutes a publication. It gets quoted, one can cite it, one can track the HVACs and all that. And there are a lot of journals that actually allow you to post the articles on the archives first before you submit to their journal. So is this double publishing now or not? And so that's one. So that's why I think some of these definitions are actually problematic, because we'll always find some particular field in our wide research enterprise which will actually be missed. That's why I would have positive statements in the exclusive rule. The second one, which I have a kind of a problem with, is it's great to have a policy on paper, but I'm worried about how we're going to implement this. So if I have to keep all my files for 7 years, paper or software or whatever, how am I going to actually store this? Who's going to pay for this? How will I actually still have the hardware to read my file, which are 7 years old, or the software, which might actually not exist anymore, or, you know, is somebody, will I actually also need the reading devices for these things? And so, it's not, I understand where I'm getting from.
It's a completely related to the initial comments that was had about the difficulty of defining data, and you know that the RAC committee, we've been discussing, in particular with the representative of the hospital, the difficulties that are associated with the current requirements and with simply logistical aspects of a requirement like this. The fact that some data has existed on the support, which is no longer in existence. So you have data that is impossible to access it or to read it, for example. So what does it mean to say that you've kept the data? And we know that the things, the support that we have now are there to stay forever. But we know that this is not the case. Probably in 3 years, the world will have already changed completely. So there are real difficulties that we are discussing very regularly with the agency within the community here, how exactly to implement a section like that.
Is it not correct that these are Granite Council requirements?
Yes, it did, but it doesn't remove the...
It doesn't remove the obligation, but I think it does put the emphasis on problem solving versus letting it go.
But congregations don't have 7 years.
They don't have 7 years.
We're more Catholic than the Pope.
Some do.
Granting agencies have different times at the moment. Sure, requires you keep your data in perpetuity. CIHR is 5 years. The policies took a leaf out of the tax legislation and set 7 years. And in part, it's to protect researchers because allegations do arise from time to time of difficulties with their work, and without their data, they cannot adequately defend themselves, etc. So some of the rules, you know, this isn't here to be negative, it is here to provide a framework that will help us all proceed with our research in an acceptable manner.
Thank you, Professor Foster. Senator Fareed.
Thank you, Senator. I have a question on section, looking especially on section 3.3. And it's basically on the students going to research. And me being a student myself and being involved in many research labs, I wasn't aware of this article. I wasn't aware
aside, section 4.6, researchers shall not remove original data from the department or research unit in which they were generated without prior approval of the chair, likely means with an expanded definition of data, you can't let me go and I'll have to bring a bed to my office. But I have several points and I'll be quite brief. 3.1, obtain all necessary approvals, including ethics. When you look at something like human subjects ethics approval, often you don't have the instruments that you're going to be using to conduct those when you're awarded the funding. So it's a timing issue there that you might want to look at. I'm a bit confused by section 3.5, researcher who engages in research activities for persons external to the university shall. There's some suggestion in the wording that that's some kind of private research, but doesn't that include all field work? And does that mean I need to obtain written approval from my chair before I go out into the field? So you might want to look a little bit at the wording of that. And it also says that you should notify someone that this is private research, which in that case would contradict seemingly with 3.10.1. Researcher shall acknowledge his or her affiliation with the university. So you're saying this is not a part of the university, but you need to acknowledge that it is a part of the university. The 3.8, researchers shall not enter into or participate in any arrangement whereby any agency or other person with a vested interest could suppress the findings. I am very cognizant of the problems of military research, but keep in mind that we're working with certain marginalized groups like Indigenous peoples. There are actually policies in place with agencies like SHRC that say that these Indigenous people have prior approval and could indeed suppress part of your findings. And so I don't know how we deal with that sort of thing in this document. And I won't go on, I've got more. I'll just end with one more. 4.6.4, in the event that data obtained from a limited access database, etc., I am, and some of my colleagues work with geographic data. Geographic data in Canada is under Crown copyright law. There is no, when one says original data, there's an implication that you own the data in some way, and under Crown copyright law, you actually never own any derivative work. So, and that's not covered by some kind of piece of paper you have to sign. So I don't know exactly how we deal with that.
Thank you for those comments. And let me say to anyone who has detailed comments, you should also feel free, since this is a discussion, to inform the next step to forward them to Vice Principal or Professor Foster. Senator Nielsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to thank the Vice Principal for the policy and all the hard work that's gone into it. I would also like to echo Professor Harp's comments by saying that perhaps 5 years is too long, and that research, that as a research-intensive institution, we should try and stay current, and that perhaps 3 years is a more reasonable time frame. I would also suggest perhaps for Section 16, and more specifically Clause 16.1, that we include a more formal framework for review, simply considering how many drafts of this policy have been circulated, and considering the communication issues between the different stakeholders that were being consulted, simply for the reason that future revisions could be implemented as efficiently as possible.
Thank you. Senator Buckley.
If there was a magic solution, I would give it to you, and everybody could follow my advice. There are discussions even to have like national storage space for data, where all universities were present their data. That's part of the discussion that are taking place right now.
Thank you.
Most of
my comments are already addressed, but I did have one general comment to talk. I'm looking at this document through the lens of human subject research, and there are very many large-scale studies being implemented now, and each of those studies tends to have in place already a set of policies for data and sample access. And in fact, oftentimes those policies require that data be released only to be used by researchers who are doing research that's covered by the consent form that the participants have already signed. So there are some statements in here about sort of the general release requirements for release of data that would actually be in contradiction to that. And I'm taking the definition of data to mean the actual data on the subject. That's just another lens to look at it through.
Thank you, Senator Cuevo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will sum my congratulations to the Vice-Principal part for putting together bits and pieces that were all over, and it was difficult to really understand where we were regarding the policy of the search. My colleagues have made a number of excellent points. I would add only one comment, which I find a bit worrisome, and this is point 4.7.1 regarding the
researcher shall make his data available after the publication to a person presenting a reasonable, etc. And in the word, in the form it is written, I think it's open to capricious request or whimsical representation. I think it's legitimate for, say, Jungner to request to attest the credibility of the data in the case there is a dispute or a major conflict. But otherwise, a person requesting in the right of form might be open to abuse.
Thank you. Senator Paul.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Regarding, so this is going back a bit, but there's a very long speakers list. Regarding the removal of the section on harmful military research, I ask for a different line of reasoning for removing this section other than simply to be in keeping with the rest of the G13. I think we can all agree that Miguel should and does strive to be a leader among the G13. And to remove this clause, I think, is a regressive step and doesn't demonstrate leadership at all. And what does suggest, however, is that we are trying to be in keeping with, trying to be as appealing to research funders as our, as the other members of the G13 are, and at the expense of our ethics. So I would hope that there would be another line of reasoning then other than to just keep up with the G13.
Yeah. In discussion that has taken place not only here but in other universities as well, the common conclusion or a common conclusion is that there's a it's a wrong equation to say military funded equals harmful and non-military funded is okay. So there's no reason to put this extra bureaucratic step on the research which is normally totally legitimate. The fundamental principle of freedom of inquiry is underlying the work that we all do here in this room.
If I may follow up quickly, I think just simply because there isn't consensus over whether military research is harmful or not harmful is precisely the reason to have that extra checkbox or bureaucratic step, as you call it.
Thank you, Senator Ferrier.
I just wanted to reinforce a comment about Section 4.7.1, and certainly it's notable that in various areas of biomedical research now, there are outside organizations that will target particular researchers that are doing studies on stem cells, on vaccination, and things like this. And I think we have to look at the wording of that to protect them against being targeted by these so-called persons. So I think this really is important.
Thank you.
Senator
Sumner. What's her name?
Three quick interventions. Back to the issue of the anonymous donations, my question is, to sort of turn around to Senator Wolf's question, what's the status of the other G13 universities on anonymous donations? Secondly, I'd just like to put on the record that PGSS Council voted, I suspect unanimously, if I recall correctly, that there should be some sort of oversight on military research akin to the sort of status quo text. The idea being that this research is to be viewed carefully as for its impacts on the broader community. In a similar way, I think this is a reasonable analogy. I was discussing this with Deputy Provost earlier. Say an environmental impact statement on a large building project. You look at the impact on the environment of a particular enterprise the same way one might look at the potential harmful impacts of a particular sort of research. And then my third point comes down to the issue of data retention. I was having a brief discussion with the university archivist the other day, and there's a project going forward using a software program called Documentum, which I understand the idea is to allow for the carefully tagged, structured metadata archival of electronic documents. So I presume something like this could work into everyday practice for researchers and help in meeting that kind of a...
Thank you.
Thank you. This university has some sad history with respect to military research. The Allen Memorial Institute was the site of a rather tragic set of events with respect to military research in the past. I think that it is incumbent upon this institution to be a kind of conscience of universities across the country on this matter. I think we can find ways, reasonable ways, of monitoring the relationship between this institution and military research without, as I think Vice Principal rightly points out, jumping to conclusions as to whether military research is necessarily problematic research. We approved recently a program that has a close connection to the military on matters of foreign policy and other oversight. So we have some experience as a body looking at appropriate, legitimate military participation in research activities, but we also have some rather horrific experience at this university with respect to inappropriate military research.
Senator Wolfson, and that'll be our last intervention. I'd like to give Professor Spross returning the last chance to respond.
I just want to make a point about that, Senator Young's comment. I believe that research at Allen is funded not by the military, but by the CIA.
That is correct, and it actually. Thanks for making the point. I decided not to make it. But I think it actually puts a very strong emphasis on not who the funder is, but on what the research is and our own accountability as a university in that regard. In fact, that was secret government-funded research. That's the way you would classify it, not as military research per se. So I think, moving into shedding daylight is generally a good way of dealing with that. We're in a very different era than we were 70 years ago at that time. Professor Foster, had you wanted to make some closing comments? And then
I leave the closing comments to my colleague, but I was going to question the validity of my colleague Yander's analogy in this situation, because it was the nature of the research, not the funder, but the facts. It was research on human subjects in an uncontrolled environment back then, and it has been addressed. And that is why we have special controls on human subject research.
Thank you, Vice Principal Tafian.
All I can say is that I think the discussion has been extremely positive and constructive. And we're going to continue our working to improve the document, and it will come back to the Senate before the end of the year.
Thank you, Senator Zoll, for reading the document so carefully and for giving a wide-ranging contribution. And I want to thank as well Professor Stephan Foster and Rosen and all who contributed to the development of the document for their work. Look, these things at the end of the day are what make us a strong university, and I actually see leadership exerted quite forcefully in no small part because of the length of time we've taken up to put our policy in place. Let me move then to 3.2 Joint Senate Board Committee on Equity. This matter is for your information. I'd like to call on the Associate Provost, Professor Foster, to make any introductory comments you'd like to fill for this, and then